Hi, and welcome to Revision Media. You're here live with me, Paul Stevenson, through with you for the next hour. That's 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. here in London, England, where I am, 5 to 6 Eastern Standard Time. Wherever you are around the world, you're very welcome. This is, of course, Thursday, the 30th of July, 2020. There goes another month. So we're actually, we've got 5 months left of this unprecedented year. And what's next, we wonder? You know, what is next? I saw a story already that Boris Johnson has grave concerns about a spike in COVID-19 cases in Europe. And of course, they disgracefully, in my opinion, destroyed the holidays of holidaymakers there out in Spain by announcing that they had less than 48 hours to get home. I think, you know, they announced it on Friday evening or Saturday, that people had to fly home by midnight on Sunday or face a two-week quarantine when they came back. I mean, this has been a pretty tough year for everybody. People out having holidays in Spain, and now they have to be quarantined when they come back. And, you know, they weren't given any notice about it, really. And it was just, yeah, it's out of order to be on holiday. And you know, you go out there thinking everything's okay, and the government basically moves the goalposts while you're there. Excuse me. Not to mention the people who have booked holidays to go out there and were looking forward to those holidays, and then realize that they either face a two-week quarantine when they come back, or in most cases, in sensible people's minds, they, you know, with jobs and livelihoods, particularly in these precarious times where those jobs and livelihoods are under threat, and we're all trying to make a few pounds as best we can. Most people are not going to go on holiday and risk being in quarantine for 2 weeks. Not everyone can sit at home and rely on their job. You know, some people could take 2 weeks off work and they might not have a job to go to. Or whatever. So the inconvenience is just totally disgraceful is the only word I can describe it, for the government to take that action. And of course, I'm going to talk about the face masks tonight again, because it's such a big thing. I don't think people really recognize how important it is. Some people do. I understand it's an inconvenience, you know, for people to not wear it, and the hassle involved, and people just want to be able to, you know, go about their lives, and if they have to wear a mask for 5 minutes, fair enough, I understand that. People think, okay, well, we'll go in there, we'll wear it, we'll come out, we don't need the hassle. But there is more at stake here with this, and we'll get to that. I'm going to talk about that tonight, as I say, because it is a big issue. And but anyway, Johnson has announced that he thinks, because of the spike in cases on the continent, that we could be less than 2 weeks away from a second wave. But the question is, you know, are any of these people really ill? Do we know anything about them? Are they close to death? Are they suffering? I mean, do they have any symptoms? Do they have mild symptoms? Do they, you know, lots of people have this virus apparently, and they're asymptomatic. I mean, in other words, so what? I mean, the headlines are always sensational. Oh, we've had a spike, we've had a rise. You know, it's always about the rise in cases. Well, so what if for most people it's not doing them any harm? Because deaths are well down, so they can't, you know, report on these increased deaths. So they have to focus on the cases. And obviously, we're doing more testing now, so there's going to be more cases. My fear is that by September, we're going to be back in lockdown again, and it's going to be a much longer lockdown. I hope that doesn't happen, but I think it could happen. And as I say, it's just one thing after the other. The economy is a mess. When they take people off the furlough, you're going to start to feel the reality of what's happened, and people should really start worrying about what the real concern is, and that is the economy. and the real pain of that will be felt for a long time. The dominoes haven't fallen yet. In no small part because the government's furlough scheme and other relief packages, by basically printing up money out of thin air that the taxpayer will have to pay back for, or someone's going to have to pay back in some way. But that's the real threat, the economic threat. You know, poverty kills. You know, you're going to see depression spike, mental health problems. You're already seeing it. People increase use of alcohol and drugs. You know, not working can cause despair. You know, poverty is not good for your health. So you're going to see all sorts of real problems coming down the tracks as a result of this utterly overhyped coronavirus illness, which could have been handled so much easier by just targeting the health services to sequester and secure the elderly and the vulnerable, which is the overwhelming demographic of people who have suffered from this illness, people with pre-existing conditions. I mean, the hype around it has been staggering. It's largely been driven by the media and by government fear-mongering. And back to what I was saying, the reason that the mask is so important is because the more compliant people are, the more the government will see that people want protected, that they're buying into it, that they're scared, that they'll wear a mask. And of course, governments want to stay in power. And the more we keep showing them that we need to be protected by our government, if you're a Christian listening, I mean, it's just idolatry to put the state above God. You know, save us from the coronavirus and then save us from your actions saving us from the coronavirus. In other words, save us from the coronavirus by locking us all down and destroying the economy, and then save us from the consequences of destroying the economy by giving us free money. And now we've got a whole situation where people don't want to go back to work. They've enjoyed their lives, being at home, not doing the commute. For the most part, people don't enjoy that. The 80% furlough, it's you know, it's pretty much most of their wages, but the rest they'll save in money they would spend on travel, a few drinks in the pub in the evening, their lunch and stuff like that. So people are better off probably. They've got more money in their pocket. How do you convince people to go back to work after they've just been not working for money? The majority of people work for money. Most people don't enjoy their job. So now you've got a whole situation where we can't get people back to work, which is obviously a massive threat to the economy as well. And who's to blame for it? I mean, the government have marched us up the hill. They've scared people to death. And even people who are not scared, and I think there's quite a lot of people who are not scared, are using it as an excuse. There was a poll done about the masks, and as I say, as long as people keep showing that they're scared and the government keeps reading it, that the people want protected, they're going to try and provide what they think that the people want for this so they can stay in power, hence why we're taking decisive action by quarantining people after they come back from Spain. That's one of the reasons anyway. So that they can be seen not to be ambiguous, because they've had criticism for not being decisive enough and being too ambiguous around the whole thing. So if they think that fear is the business to be in, then let's keep pushing the fear and we'll protect you from it. And you keep, you know, keep us in power. So there's a lot at stake with these masks. Obviously, it's a civil liberty issue in my mind. People who think that governments have our best intentions at heart, they really, really need to look at the history of governments. Governments, the larger they get, the more out of control they get and the more they want to control. Governments and politicians are supposed to be in the business of service, whereas in reality, they're in the business of imposing servitude. That's the business they're in. They're in the business of pathological audacity. The more ground you give up to them, the more they'll take. And the more ground you give up to them, the weaker you'll be. And you have to draw a line in the sand sooner or later. And the sooner you do it, the better, because they'll have less power and less control, and less, they'll bring less legislation in, because There's an old saying, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. Once these guys have these powers, they'll probably never give them up. Or they certainly won't give them up when they say they will anyway. So there is a lot at stake with this, I believe. And we've got our children to think about, and the next generation to think about, and what's normal for them. We've enjoyed a certain amount of freedoms. The baby boomer generation got, you know, fat on the calf. They believed everything that came out of mainstream media. They watched all the soaps. They enjoyed themselves. The next generation are now suffering because of that complacency. And the generation after that will suffer even more. My generation has seen it one way and have seen the changes. My son's generation, as an adult, he hasn't known anything. He's 16 now and he's seen all this. I refuse to let him wear a mask. If he's with his mum and they wear one, that's fine. But I mean, I can't, you know, have authority when I'm not there. Although he's actually very good. He does, you know, listen to me even when I'm not there. So, but, you know, we've got our children and the next generation to think about. People should not be so complacent about government. It can end very, very badly. And we're already seeing it. We're seeing huge amounts of censorship on social media by anyone who has any kind of conservative views, any kind of traditional views, any kind of Christian views. If you say anything positive about white people, about Christianity, if you say anything negative about immigration, or that, you know, that mass immigration is counterintuitive to the national interest, any of these things are heresies to the religion of political correctness or cultural Marxism. It's the same thing. And it's now on steroids with this kind of woke movement, which basically is obsessed with being offended, is obsessed with virtue signaling, is addicted to their drug of choice of feeling good and feeling morally superior. When they're a bunch of idiots, basically, and a total liability if you want to live in a free country. But they're just blinded, and as I say, they're drug addicts, and their drug of choice is their moral superiority. But make no mistake about it, it has all the hallmarks of a religion. It has the priesthood, the priestly class of the celebrities, the Lewis Hamiltons of this world, the Serena Williams of this world, the David Beckhams of this world. It has its dogmas and its doctrines of diversity, inclusivity, tolerance, they think. These people are not tolerant. See how tolerant when you disagree with them. Absurd, egalitarian notions, unrealistic ideas of egalitarianism, distorted views of egalitarianism, where equality is based around equality of outcome. Total Marxism. So it has its dogmas and its doctrines. And any dissenters are heretics. And if they could burn you at the stake, I believe these people would be happy to. Because it's not, when you're dealing with this crowd, you're not dealing with rational people who are interested or capable, in my opinion, of critical thinking. So you have a mature debate. For the most part, these people on the far left, I mean, they're so far out of sight. I mean, so they're so far left. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, Stalin would be more right wing than some of these people. But you can't reason with them. They are a mob. And you're not misguided, so you don't have a mature conversation. You are evil. This is a moral crusade for them. You see, there is no neutrality. Man is a religious creature. He will find his religion in something, whether it's the environment, whether it's in football, or whether it's in this woke religion. And as I say, it's a moral crusade. And if you step outside the boundaries and you're not adhering to the doctrines, you're a heretic. Now, as I say, you might not get burned at the stake, but these people are so hateful, I'm sure they wish they could. But you'll suffer in other ways. You'll be silenced. You will be censored on YouTube. You will have your videos deleted. You will be shadow banned. You will have your whole channel deleted, like E. Michael Jones, who I've been interviewing for years. None of us were inciting hatred or violence, like YouTube say, or, you know, violating their guidelines. The irony is it's the same group of people in the same establishment who have not only not not condemned the Black Lives Matter rioting and the livelihoods and the deaths that the livelihoods they've destroyed and the deaths that have resulted and the absolute chaos that's going on in some of the American cities, but in many cases they've encouraged it and rewarded it. These people are encouraging violence because it's for their religion. It's a moral cause. And if there has to be some collateral damage, well, so be it. But the hypocrisy and the double standard is so odious. People are getting sick and tired of it. They really are. And the whole woke movement, it's like they're competing with each other for virtue signaling on their echo chambers in Twitter et al. And it's basically ultimately destined to implode and collapse under its own degenerate, hypocritical, false weight. And this whole coronavirus thing with the mask is part of it. Because if you don't wear a mask, you are visibly now seen to be a dissenter. And again, it's a moral crusade. People will be looking at you with hostility and may even approach you, not to say, why are you not wearing a mask, but to say, why don't you care? Why don't you respect people? Why do you want to hurt people? The narrative, I heard it in the radio today, that's how it was framed. And the media is not happy that about 95, 96, 97% of people are wearing masks. The aggression of these people is staggering. They want to make sure that the 2 or 3% of people who are not wearing masks in those stores, notwithstanding there are a lot of people wearing masks who don't want to wear one, but for whatever reason are wearing one, and then there's other people who've just decided not to even go to the shops, but they don't want any of those dissenters there because that's a danger. If I walk into Tesco, and I've been to Tesco and Sainsbury's and lots of these other shops, I embody someone who is not been compliant, and I can be seen to walk in there and walk out there without any consequences, and that reveals the audacity of the government, because I have walked in and walked out several times, probably a dozen times now. No one's approached me. Actually, one time I was approached, but I've had problems with this guy, a security guard, is just he's just a bit of a power freak, and I had the conversation with the supervisor, and he was actually overruled by the manager and said, listen, you can't be hassling people. Most people are obeying the rules, and we're not here to be aggressive and enforce the rules to, you know, aggressively to people who are not aware of them. You don't know that guy might have a pre-existing condition or whatever. But the fact is, the supermarkets have come out and said they're not going to enforce it. And the police have said they're not going to come out and enforce it either because they don't have the manpower. So this is audacity on the state's part. And again, when they push, they take more ground. And already you're hearing calls for we should be wearing masks in other areas, more ubiquitous, widespread wearing of masks. This is how they work. They're like bullies. You never give in to a bully, because the bully will always want more. He's not going to be happy just punching you in the face. He wants to get on top of you and completely destroy you. And the next thing he wants to destroy and embarrass and humiliate your girlfriend in front of you. I mean, you cannot allow bullies to gain ground and to do what they do. And as I said before, and I've said it to my church, you need to take a stand when you've got strength. There's no point trying to take a stand when the bullies punch the face off you and you're struggling. And it's just a last desperate attempt, and he's got all the energy and the power, and you're weak. And for some people, this might sound like, you know, this is I'm being over the top. Go and study what happened with Russia and the Bolshevik Revolution there. It was horrible. What was it Alexander Solzhenitsyn said? Alexander Solzhenitsyn was he won a Nobel Prize for Literature. And he spent a large proportion of his life in the gulags. And he said, quote, "You must understand the leading Bolsheviks who took over Russia were not Russians. They hated Russians. They hated Christians. Driven by ethnic hatred, they tortured and slaughtered millions of Russians without a shred of human remorse. It cannot be understated that Bolshevism committed the greatest human slaughter of all time. The fact that most of the world is ignorant and uncaring about this enormous crime is proof that the global media is in the hands of the perpetrators." Now, Alexander Solzhenitsyn there was talking about Jews. And the global media is in the hand of Jews, as is the global finance system. The Federal Reserve are a Jewish privately owned bank who bribed their way into the American system to get control of the money supply. And in a century, they have completely destroyed the American monetary system and brought it to its knees, where it's like the debt can never be paid back. They're inflating the currency like there's no tomorrow by printing money out of thin air. But listen, he said, they hated Christians and they hated Russians. And they were, what were they driven by? Ethnic hatred. Ethnic hatred. Yeah, they hate white people. They hate the Europeans. And they are driven by revenge because of their expulsion out of every European country in their history. And why did they get expelled? Usury and rapine. Money printing, lending money at interest, what they're doing now, and theft. And what you're seeing now is the central banks is the biggest daylight robbery in human history. The elephant is so big in the room that people just can't see it. If I had a printing press in my room here and I printed up as much as £100 and was found out to be doing so, I'd be arrested. I'd get into all kinds of trouble for that. But if you happen to be the Federal Reserve, you can print up trillions and nothing happens to you. Because you're part of a criminal syndicate. That's what you're part of. It's not a banking system. It's a criminal syndicate. Paul Volcker was the chairman in the 70s or in the early 80s. Then Alan Greenspan. Who was Alan Greenspan? He's a Jew. Who's Ben Bernanke? Ben Bernanke's a Jew. Who's Janet Yellen? She's a Jew. Is this just coincidence? I don't think so. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I could go on. I've documented much of this in my shows over the years, names of people and this conspiracy. But yeah, the masks. I mean, just because they tell us. I mean, I covered a story last week that Peter Hitchens revealed that the World Health Organization had advised that masks make no difference at all to preventing the spread of coronavirus, and that they were actually lobbied by the conservative government to say otherwise. I mean, that's Peter Hitchens. He writes for the Daily Mail. This is in the mainstream media. I haven't heard any of the mainstream media companies covering it. In fact, I'm going to play a clip from... you know what? An hour's not enough. It really isn't. I might have to start this show a bit earlier and do 2 hours to get through it. But Mike Graham from Talk Radio, I mean, as far as real information is concerned, rather than the propaganda that we get out of BBC News, Sky News, Channel 4, just basically Marxist media, Talk Radio is somewhat of an oasis. I don't agree with everything they say, but, you know, they are in the right direction, and they do interview people like Peter Hitchens. Right throughout this whole coronavirus thing, Peter Hitchens has been a rare voice of reason in all of this. I disagree with very little the man has to say. He knows what's going on economically. He knows what's going on culturally. He knows what's going on with this facade of the coronavirus. He's got perspective on it, which has been totally lost in all of this. I'm not saying that the coronavirus hasn't killed people, or that we should be, you know, if we can prevent the spread of it in some ways, we should be cautious about it, of course. But you don't just shut down the whole economy for it. I mean, it's totally disproportional action. And the cure will be worse than the disease. And we haven't experienced that yet, but it's coming. This is going to be the most expensive summer holiday that the West has ever had and this country's ever had. It's and the furloughs and the extra, all the money been printed up and the helicopter money. It's going to be the most expensive free lunch ever served. Certainly the cure is worse than the disease. So it's just all perspective has been lost. The other voice of reason is Lord Jonathan Sumption, the ex-High Court judge, who has been very, you know, on cue with all of this and on the ball with it and doing some proper thinking with it. Because there are very few others, either through ignorance or because they're not interested in telling people the truth. But I'll just play a clip that he did with an epidemiologist during the week. Because the other question, of course, is there any evidence to suggest that these masks actually do any good? There's an article I want to cover, and I'm not sure I'm going to have time, in Global Research, Michael Chozodowski's site, by a professor, I think he is an epidemiologist, which suggests that the masks are doing more harm than good. And I'm not sure if I'm going to have time to cover that, but I'll get this guy in. If I can just pull up the clip. His name's Ivor Cummings, I think his name is. He's an Irish guy. So it's an interview on talk radio. It's 9 minutes, so we can get this. We've got time for this. But yeah, I may well try and extend the show by half an hour just to get more into it, because there is just so much information and so much to cover in a short period of time. I'm reluctant to do YouTube videos anymore because I know the shadow banning is so severe, and I know by looking at the analytics that they are preventing even my listeners, even my subscribers, from knowing or getting the notifications that I'm doing a video. So if you can just see a downward pattern in the analytics over the last 18 months and exponentially over the last year and 6 months, nothing new. As I say, E. Michael Jones had his channel deleted. People right across the spectrum, from anything from even center left to center to center right to more extreme right, they're all being censored. They're all fascists. They're all Nazis. These people don't even know what fascism is. I mean, their solution for alleged fascism is actual fascism. They are the fascists. It's a fascist trait to censor and to aggressively restrict free speech. Anyway, this guy is called Ivor Cummings. He's a biochemical engineer. He said, quote, in this interview, in all the countries so far, it's quite clear the introduction of mandatory curves had no effect on the R-value curve. So he's looking at this not just from a scientific point of view, but from a historical data point of view, as to looking at other countries where these masks have been mandatory, and it's had no effect. Imagine my surprise. So this is Professor Ivor Cummings.
With Brain Power, we are joined by Ivor Cummings, biochemical engineer and the author of the best-selling Eat Rich, Live Long. Ivor, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Great to be here again.
Your engineering background means that you've looked at the data so far in terms of the world's handling of this pandemic. You are something of a lockdown skeptic, to say the least. I'd love to come to that shortly. What's your view on face coverings and particularly the mandatory rule kicking in within the UK today, £100 fine if you're not wearing
Well, Mark, I was profoundly surprised a couple of weeks ago when this new movement suddenly sprang up. And it was based on the fact that in Northern Europe, it's clear that the epidemics have waned. And that's a normal phenomenon, actually. And we seem to be coming out of lockdown and things were looking really good. So great success in many ways, in spite of, sadly, of course, many deceased, mostly aged and comorbid. But when this came out mandatory, I almost couldn't believe it. So in Ireland, we've got a prison sentence and a €2,500 fine. So that's the threat.
Extraordinary.
And why? It's extraordinary because there's a few facets to it, but to bring it in, the first one, at the end of the waning epidemic, where we've reached, in the UK and Ireland, 400 to 600 deceased per million inhabitants, similar to Sweden, with no lockdown, that's kind of the burnout zone of this particular virus, all the data would suggest, and you've got a lot of community immunity, and that's the main reason that the impacts fall, and the susceptible have passed away, sadly.
Yeah.
And so to bring in masks when it's waning in the summer season makes no real sense. And one reason is that some of this fear-mongering, I believe, is based on the 1918 Spanish flu. But what people should realize is that the second wave in the 1918 flu was essentially a new virus. So it's debated whether it was a virus from the late 1800s or a very great mutation in the influenza virus from the first wave.
Right.
But either way, it's not the same virus. So the whole concept and fear of a second wave makes no scientific sense. So as we come out of an epidemic and it's waning, you actually are as well off getting it to finally spread in the safe season. And then you'll have more protection in a few months' time if it seasonally resurges in the winter, which is not uncommon. Or indeed if a mutation arose, though coronaviruses are much, much less likely to mutate compared to influenza, so that's a good thing. But either way, suppressing now makes no scientific sense. So it's fascinating how such a drive has come in at this point in time.
It's pretty clear, is it not, Ivor, that if there was a worrying uptick in cases of coronavirus, then perhaps people might be persuaded that the mask is worth a punt, even if the science is divided, let's try it. But numbers are coming down mercifully. I wonder whether there is a potential bad side effect, which is perhaps the masks will hinder the development of this much maligned herd immunity that you think is actually not such a bad thing in the first place.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's debatable. I would say on that, I always go by the science, the published science. And for around 40 years now, we have had myriad publications around mask use in the instance of a viral transmission. And there's been a consensus in science for many decades in all the publications that they are near useless in a general sense. The phenomenon that happened in June 2020 was a flurry of scientific papers came out, interestingly, and they are modeling and associational papers justifying that masks may be useful. And that's a very weak form of science. So I would put 40 years of scientific publications ahead of a few weeks of relatively weak science publications.
So it begs the question, if you've had 40 years and have largely a consensus within the, you know, within the epidemiologists and people who are, you know, knowledgeable and expert, have expertise in this area, and the evidence is that masks have little or no effect when it comes to stopping the spread of these type of viruses, suddenly there's a huge U-turn. So that begs the question, well, why is this U-turn? It's called politics.
So that's
probably another.
We've had four decades of science saying masks are not particularly effective, and 4 weeks in which a few scientists got together thinking it is a good idea. What about these droplets we hear so much about, though? Because, you know, to the layman like myself, if we are spreading this COVID-19 virus through water vapor and droplets, then any kind of covering seems logical.
Yes, and it would seem intuitively logical. The problem is, in real life, often intuition fails us. So there's an amusing video out there at the moment, and I thought it was quite interesting. And a guy has a standard face mask, like a surgical mask. He inhales a vape, and then he puts the mask back on and simply exhales, and a huge cloud of vapor emerges till you can no longer even see his head. And that kind of illustrates the problem with viruses in microaerosol is that they may not go forward in a cloud because the mask is in the way, but they essentially just stream out through the low resistance gaps at the side of the mask, and then they remain suspended and in the room or the environment. So for gobbets of spittle with bacteria when a surgeon is operating, by all means, the mask will stop gobbets going down into a wound and bringing bacteria. But the reality is, the reason 4 decades of science have said that they're ineffective for viral transmission is quite well kind of encapsulated in that video. The virus is extremely small in tiny droplets, and the flow of air doesn't go through the mask so easily. It shoots out through all the gaps. So that's just one illustration of why the science has been in concordance for many decades.
Now, we can talk to you forever, Ivor, but one question...
Okay, because I'm short of time, I'm going to cut that there, but I think you get the picture. It's nonsense, according to this guy, and apparently according to 40 years of peer-reviewed science. The consensus has been that masks make no difference, and they are a futile attempt at preventing the spread of a virus, or these types of viruses like flu and coronavirus, etc., of which COVID-19 is just a mere one of them. So that's Ivor Cummins. You can hear that interview if you want to listen more on Talk Radio. It was about 6 days ago, I suppose about a day after the new mandatory face mask rules came in, which, as I say, I haven't obeyed once and haven't had any consequences. I had a fine today for a parking ticket, which is, to me, more likely to occur than getting a fine for... not wearing a mask. I mean, the police force, on average, fail to solve 93% of burglary cases or something like that. I think it's 90, 93. And it takes them half an hour to come out to respond to burglary, calls. So quite rightly, they came out and said, we haven't got the manpower to police us. So it's just, it's a total boondoggle, really, the whole thing. But they will try and increase it, and they will try and bring more pressure, and they will try and shame people and weaponize the public. A bit like those zombie movies where it's just like it's the zombies you fear. It's the people themselves that are becoming more frightening because they are so compliant and so supine and so obedient to a corrupt government. And a year ago, it would be unthinkable that to think that going into a supermarket without a mask would be somehow a crime. I mean, corrupt governments make criminals of law-abiding citizens. It's not the citizens that have changed. It's the government has increased its control and escalated its power grab. And then they've moved the goalposts so that you stuff that was a year ago was perfectly fine is now criminal behavior, and you can get a fine for it. This is how governments work. Certainly how big socialist fascist governments work. Okay, gold and silver has been up massively in the last week or so. Okay, there is a fair bit of volatility. Silver has lost a little bit of ground in the last 36 hours, but it's still holding some ground there around, I think, $17.23 or £17, £17.50, somewhere like that. $23. So it did go as far as, like, I think $25.50. Obviously, some people would have sold off because they may be stacking some silver over the last 10 years. It's been a very long bear market. Some people probably wanted to make some money on it after, you know, holding it for so long when it was when the price was so low. I'm going to play a clip from Mike Maloney. Very good guy. If you want to find out about currency, about macroeconomics, about precious metals, and of course much of this rise in the precious metals is as a result of the devaluing of currency and the inflating of the currency by the central banks printing money out of thin air, which basically does devalue the currency and creates inflation. And this is always has been seen in a rise in people going into gold and silver and precious metals apart from anything else to hedge against inflation. So I'm going to play a clip. I mean, it's not the only reason, but the general economic fragility and precariousness that's going on is making people start to turn and look at gold and silver, as is common in financial crisis territory that we've seen. We've seen it in the 70s. You saw it. You saw it in 2001 with the dot-com bubble. You saw it in the crash, in the housing market crash in 2008, and the credit crunch. And you're seeing it now. And I think it's just going to be an even bigger rise than any of those, because that was just a, you know, what we're experiencing now is kind of Great Depression stuff. You're seeing a currency crisis. You're seeing a sovereign debt crisis. You're seeing a stock market bubble. You're seeing a property bubble, as you guys in America call it, the real estate bubble. You're seeing bubbles everywhere, basically, because the whole world is over leveraged with debt, particularly the West. And the Federal Reserve and the central banks are literally basically playing chicken with a economic reality freight train, and it is going to be very ugly, and it's already starting. So Mike Maloney here, and actually they talk about the perplexing, and of course these guys don't usually get out of their lanes, they sort of tend to stay in the economic stuff, but they do talk about the perplexing phenomena of the suppression of the effectiveness and the data revealing the effectiveness of hydroxychloroquine in dealing with coronavirus. And our so-called, you know, experts and the technocracy epitomized and personified in Dr. Fauci, these people masquerade as caring about the people and, you know, public health, and they ignore the effectiveness that the data has revealed. It's not speculation in other countries, because this drug deals with effectively with malaria. And they found that there are many countries who have had a lot of success with hydroxychloroquine in dealing with the coronavirus. But of course, you know, they would prefer to suppress that for whatever reason. One of the reasons, I think, is because they want to roll out this vaccine. But anyway, this is a good little video, but it talks about, you know, the background and, you know, the situation with the rise in gold and silver in the economy, and of course the what I've just mentioned about hydroxychloroquine. So this is Mike Maloney and some guests he had on.
If we have the same amount of run-up that we had from the low in 2000 to the high in 2011, that was a factor of more than seven times. And if we go from the bottom in 2015 of $1,100, we're talking about gold in the $8,000 area, which does sort of make sense. Hi, this is Mike Maloney, and we had such a great response from the video we did last week with Jeff Clark and Chris Martinson that we're going to try and make this a regular thing. How are you doing, Chris?
Hey, I'm doing really well, Mike. As you can see in the background, I'm taking a COVID-responsible, separate vacation. I'm taking a little time off this week.
Excellent. And Jeff, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mike, and it's great to be back with both of you. This will be fun.
Yeah, it looks like for you, it's, you know, there's no break from work for the weary. You're hard at it still.
Yeah, not when gold and silver are running.
Right. So, anyway, the response last week was great, so we're going to continue doing this. And I want to turn it over to you, Jeff, so you can start asking us some random questions and we'll respond.
Great. There's a lot of interesting developments this week, and so we've got another slew of articles that we're going to go through. I'm going to throw these out to you guys. But first, I'll just highlight that as of yesterday's close, we're recording here on a Wednesday, through Tuesday, gold is now up 28.6% year-to-date. Silver is up 35.6% year-to-date. So both assets are really running. So the natural question that we've gotten from a lot of people is this it? Is this the big rise in gold and silver that we've all talked about for so many years and for so long? Is this the beginning of that phase now? So Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think, you put a comment in on one of our communication channels about how every time the gold and silver break into new highs or do a breakout. Silver isn't into new highs, but it's done a breakout. There's all these commentators that say
stay away from gold. That was it. It's going to fall, you know. And they all start warning about gold. When has that ever happened with the general stock markets? You don't hear that with the Dow and the NASDAQ and the S&P. It's just crazy for them to think that. And gold is money. And it's responding. It hasn't even finished responding. It's nowhere near finished responding to the expansion of the currency supply. There's currency and there's money. And the money has been lagging the expansion of the currency supply big time. So gold has, in my opinion, has a lot of catching up to do. When it comes to all of the ratios, like the Dow gold ratio, the gold real estate ratio, it's nowhere near the peaks that it was at. And that's your last article, Jeff, was about that, the value of gold and silver versus, you know, people always talk about the price, but there was an entire section of my first book entitled Don't Tell Me the Price, What's the Value? Because the price doesn't mean anything. It's how much stuff can you buy with it. And gold and silver have a long way to run. It's going to be choppy. But Chris, what's your opinion on this?
Oh, yeah, we're just getting at the beginning of all this. And it's kind of a long answer, but the simplest way I can put it is the central banks are cornered. There's nothing they can do but print. There is no alternative to printing. So that's what they're going to do. As they do that, they deform all sorts of markets, but the biggest market they deform is the bond market. And now if you take a chart of gold price relative to the amount of negative yielding bond debt out there in the world, it's a ridiculously high correlation. So you remember, Mike, you and I had to put up with this for years. Oh, don't hold gold. It doesn't pay any interest. Well, now we can say, yeah, but at least it doesn't cost you negative interest, right? And so what happens when you get that negative interest rate environment? You get big money moving into gold. We've just started to see some of the first articles coming out about how private money, this is family offices, pensions starting to say, hey, maybe, you know. So the big money, when it starts to move into gold, that tells you we're at the beginning of this whole thing. And I don't think they've even really started yet, but except at the very, very beginning of that. So negative interest rates, I see more of those coming. That's why I think gold is just getting started.
Yeah, you know, I said quite a while ago that for silver to get into triple digits and for this market, the third phase of this market would be marked by monetary demand. What we've had so far is speculative demand. And the run up from 250 to 1900 that happened from 2000 to 2011, that was a greed-driven mania. And now we're starting to see people worry about currencies, worry about fiat currencies. And negative interest rates is a sign of a world gone crazy. That's not possible under anything except Keynesian economics. It's totally insane to have negative interest rates, to loan somebody your currency and them to charge you for the risk of loaning it to them and not getting paid back or getting paid back in inflated currency. So I think that this past week marks the beginning of the third and final phase of this bull market. And like I said in my video yesterday, there's a lot more wrong in the world today economically than there was in 1979 and early 1980 when gold peaked. You know, if we have the same amount of run-up that we had from the low in 2000 to the high in 2011, that was a factor of more than seven times. And if we go from the bottom in 2015 of $1,100, we're talking about gold in the $8,000 area, which does sort of make sense. But you know, things are actually much worse out there economically than they have ever been. So anyway, back to you, Jeff. What's the next topic?
Yes, and on a related note, and as you were saying, Chris, I think we're actually starting to see some other mainstream and Wall Street investors come into the gold sector. Here's an article on Bloomberg just this morning gold search an all-time high is winning over a wider fan base of pension funds, insurance companies, and private wealth specialists. And on top of that, there's an article on Zero Hedge talking about how millennials may flood into the precious metal sector. And is gold the next Tesla? Tesla stock, as we all know, is gone up a lot. So what do you guys think? Are we seeing a wave now of the mainstream and Wall Street investors coming into this sector? Because if we are, there's an awful lot of cash on the sidelines that could really, really ignite this market, even more than what we've seen.
Well, Jeff, I've seen some really exciting things, and I've been watching this market for a long time. And let me tell you something that I know you guys are more familiar than I, is that when gold would have a run, you would watch the banks develop a larger and larger and larger short position. We would look at this in the paper futures market in COMEX, and this would be called the relative short position of the commercial hedgers, the big bullion banks, right? They would just get shorter and shorter and shorter, and then you'd watch these crushing raves come in, usually around 1:30 in the morning when the markets are thin, right? They would just dump tons of contracts and drive the price down, wash, rinse, repeat. So looking at the trading patterns this time, we see the same thing. We see the commercials getting really long, and we see the speculators, which is another big, that's the hedge funds. They're in there, the managed money. They're a big category, but there's this other category called other that's gotten really big this time, and that includes some of the people you just mentioned. So we watch gold blast through its all-time high. We watch it running towards 2,000, just like clockwork, Monday night. Crush, crush, two big hits. You know what happened? Gold and silver rebounded. And I've been waiting a long time to watch their little magic, middle of the night raids not work. And I think that's a very bullish sign right here. And it's in part because of that other category. They may not be there to trade and try and make a few bucks. They're there to maybe hold that and maybe take delivery. And that's what I think is starting. We're starting to get the first whiffs of that, that there may be a delivery issue coming up. And I'm sticking to that. I think there's a strong chance we see that here in 2020. If so, watch out for prices. They're going to go sky high, I think.
Yeah. You know, another thing, another factor as far as all this big money, this is something it's part of a chapter that I was writing for the Great Gold and Silver Rush of the 21st Century. And I'm, a book that I'm still working on. And this COVID-19 thing has sort of thrown a wrench into a lot of that because it's sped it up so much that stuff is becoming outdated as I can write it. But I did a video quite a while back that was about the all of the different factors in this market. And there were 10 different factors. That, I can't even remember the name of the series of the videos right now. But I was talking about how there were 10 times more people. Well, it's actually, I've refined the numbers. There's twice as much gold in them. But back in the 1970s, during that bull market, nobody in the USSR could legally buy gold. In China, under Mao, you could be put to death for hoarding gold. Basically, only about 10% of the population has about doubled since then on the planet, but only about 10% of that population that was half of what it is today could invest in gold. There were a lot of countries that could buy it in South America and Mexico and stuff, but I took, I went down to Mexico back then, and I had never seen poverty like that in my life. You had either dirt poor countries with no commodities exchange in those countries, or you had countries where it was just illegal, and it wasn't legal for Americans to own until the first day of 1975, and Australians until the first day of 1976. So basically, today we have 17 times more people that can buy gold and silver on this planet, and only twice as much gold as before. So this is a recipe, and that's only one of the many, many factors. And then you look at what the Federal Reserve has done directing so much funds. When they create new currency and buy assets, they have to get it into circulation, they've got to buy something. They create currency, they buy something. What do they buy? They have to buy some sort of government security. So they buy bonds, and they buy those usually from the big brokerage houses. And so the brokers are now flush with cash, and the correlation between the creation of currency and the rise in the value of the stock market is astounding. I think it was 0.976 or something like that, which is, that's just huge. I mean, it means there's almost no chance that this is an accident. And if from 2009 to today, if Amazon stock has gone up 34 times and Microsoft has gone up more than tenfold, while your income hasn't really gone up much at all, that means that the Federal Reserve is printing currency and giving it directly to the world's richest people.
Very good. That's an excellent point. Thank you, Mike. One of the themes that we got from the questions last week was, is it too late for me? There are a group of people out there that have not actually bought into precious metals yet or built some kind of resilient lifestyle for the type of crisis that's ahead. So, Chris, you first. Is it too late for someone to start to build a resilient lifestyle? Do they have to be wealthy to do so? And what are the, just very briefly, what are the first things they should be focusing on if they haven't started this process yet?
Well, if you haven't started, this is the best time to get started. The second best time was a few years ago. And but absolutely, that we are at the beginning innings of these big changes that are coming. My point of view, listen, I might be wrong, but I'm not confused about this. We've had a massive debt bubble. It created the everything bubble, everything except for a few commodities. That's bursting. They're printing money like crazy. As Mike said, they're handing it to the rich people. All of these are recipes for things to go a little haywire. So becoming resilient, very important concept. Be financially resilient if you haven't bought any gold or silver. And I'm not talking GLD or SLV. These are nice to own or even gold mining shares. I mean physical gold in your hot little hands. That's the place to start. Everybody has to have that as an insurance policy. When's the right time to buy an insurance policy? Before you need it. So this would be a good time. And like Mike, I'm not price sensitive about gold or silver. We can look at this and say, we're on a price basis, were there better times to buy? Yes, just a few weeks ago even. But the right question to be asking is, do I have my insurance policy in place? If the answer is no, you got to figure out how you're going to get that. So that's just a defined amount of gold and or silver you're going to put in your insurance policy. Once you have that, now you can take a deep breath and start figuring out if you want to add to that and create more of a reserve buffer. And then there we would suggest, hey, just dollar cost average. Don't try and be smarter than the markets. As Mike said, they chop. They go up and down, and there's going to be a lot of price movements along the way. That's the nature of these things. But beyond that, once you've got your financial house in order like that, then I would suggest people start looking at building other forms of resilience into their life. This could include, where's your food coming from? Where's your water? How do you heat your house? How do you cool your house? These are all investments people can make who own homes and that have fantastic returns, better than anything Wall Street could ever promise you if you go about them in a thoughtful way. So yes, now is a great time to begin your resilience in no small measure because we've really only begun this period of disruption, volatility that I think is going to be happening financially, socially, across all sorts of dimensions, politically. It's really just getting started.
Yes, what do you think, Mike, for the person who hasn't really started protecting themselves with their money?
Well, I never make, I don't give advice, so I don't make recommendations. But for me, what I see out there is that for anybody that waits too long, I've often talked about the day that gold and silver become unaffordium and unobtainium. And already we've seen Pan American Mining announced, and they're one of the largest primary silver producers, and they announced that they shuttered two of their mines, the mines in Peru, I believe it was, because some of the workers tested positive for COVID. And so they can't send these guys down into a hole working in close proximity with each other. And I said that earlier in the year, that just when everybody wants it, it's going to be in very, very short supply. And we're also seeing the U.S. Mint.
All right, folks, that is Mike Maloney, gold and silver, just discussing the whole precious metals market and the implications of the central banks printing up the money and the whole economic background as to why gold and silver are set for the moon. So you can listen to that. As I say, Mike Maloney, he's got some great videos. Also, another guy I would recommend to listen to if you want to learn stuff is Peter Schiff as well. Anyway, I'll be back again next week. Thank you for tuning in. And until next week, take care of yourselves. God bless. As I say, that will be, the 6th, is it? 6th, 7th of August, next Thursday. Same time, 9 till 10 here at UK time, 5 till 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Until then, thank you for joining me and goodbye.